Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Consular officers, the men and women who work in the U.S. consulate offices inside embassies around the world, are often the face of the U.S. government abroad. And at a time when many Americans who are or will be traveling abroad may be concerned about U.S. foreign relations or changing travel rules, we've asked two consular officers who both grew up in Iowa and are both named Jeff to help take us behind embassy walls to find out what services they can provide to U.S. citizens. Jeff Osweiler is here. He grew up in Ames, Iowa. He's worked in embassies in Nigeria, Morocco, Madagascar, Tunisia, and now he's in Montreal, Canada. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Jeff Gringer is also here with us. He grew up in Iowa City, and he's been posted in Armenia, France, Pakistan, in Washington, D.C., at the Visa office, Lebanon, and now he's in Stockholm. Hello, Jeff.
Good afternoon, or good morning, I should say. Nice to hear you from Stockholm.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And Jeff Osweiler, let's start with you. What drew you to the Foreign Service?
Well, I'd always been interested in international affairs and public service, and being a Foreign Service officer is sort of the perfect union of those things. It was just sort of a natural extension of my studies and an interest in being overseas.
Well, and the interest in being overseas, when you become a part of this organization, what kind of a commitment are you making to living abroad?
Well, you do make a commitment to worldwide availability, so you're subject to assignment at any of our embassies or consulates overseas, of course, depending on, you know, medical clearances and other things that might prevent you from going to certain places. But it's really a commitment to serve the world and to serve the United States anywhere we're posted.
And is there a time commitment as well that you'll be a part of this for a certain number of years?
Well, it depends on the assignment. Some assignments are 2 years, some are 3 years. That depends on the location, the security conditions, the health conditions, a number of different things. But usually most assignments are between 2 and 3 years.
And Jeff Gringer, what drew you into the Foreign Service?
I was motivated much the same way. I was interested in all things international. I was always a big history buff. And I was just fascinated going overseas and seeing other cultures with other languages. And I just, I'm just fascinated by that. And again, like my colleague, Mr. Osweiler, says, working in the Foreign Service gives you prime opportunity to do those things and help other Americans that experience difficulties overseas.
And this is not like a regular job. Getting a job in the Foreign Service is a little more complicated than just applying. Jeff Gringer, what does it take to be a part of the Foreign Service?
Well, you take the Foreign Service exam. It's offered publicly, free of charge, however many times a year they need to fill the positions. And then after that, there's an evaluation process, a winnowing down of the applicants that culminates in the oral exam. And then depending on your score, you can be offered a contingent position once you pass the medical and the background evaluation. Then you can be put in a class.
And Jeff Osweiler, once you make it into the Foreign Service, do you have any control over where you're going to go in the world?
Well, your first two assignments are what they call directed tours. So really you're assigned based on the needs of the service. So there's a list, and you can express preferences. And you know, usually they try and assign you to places that correspond to your needs or the needs of your family. But really it's the needs of the service that drive the nature of your assignment. After those first two assignments, there's a little different process where you kind of lobby and bid for different positions that are available. But a lot of it is what's available at the time you're available for assignment and serendipity. And that's, I think, one of the exciting things about the career.
And you mentioned the needs of your family. Your family goes with you most of the time, right?
Most of the time. I've been very lucky. Every posting I've had except for one, my family's been with me. It's an incredible experience for them as well. A lot of moving, and that can be difficult, and it gets harder as the children get older. But I think as the years go on, they develop a greater appreciation for it as we go from post to post.
Well, let's talk about what you actually do on a day-to-day basis. And Jeff Gringer, you can start us out here. And what is the job description of a consular officer?
Well, We do two sorts of work. We're mainly going to be discussing American citizen services, but a lot of my work revolves around issuing visas, immigrant and non-immigrant. But turning the page and going to American citizen services, we provide routine consular citizenship services. So we renew passports, issue passports, and then for children born overseas of American citizens, we can confirm their claim to U.S. nationality with a consular report of birth abroad that would in turn enable us to issue a passport. And we can also do notarials here. Jeff might want to mention some of the special consular services we do on an emergency basis.
Well, and that's where I was just going to go.
Okay.
So if I'm traveling abroad and I run into trouble, what might make me want to turn to a consular officer?
Well, the most common thing we see in that situation is lost or stolen passports. Even here in Stockholm, we see a lot of bags snatched. Pickpockets, what have you, and people need to get home. And we can issue an emergency passport. We confirm people's IDs and their claim to citizenship, and we can issue them an emergency passport good for up to 1 year. That's a very common service.
Well, and I can just imagine how incredibly overwhelmed and helpless someone might feel if they do have their passport stolen while they're traveling abroad. I mean,
it can be pretty traumatic for some people, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Jeff Osweiler, do you feel like people know what the embassy does? Do you feel like people know that if something like that happens to them, that you're the place to turn to?
I think so. We try every day to get the message out through various mechanisms about what to do if you do lose or have lose your passport or have it stolen. As Jeff Gringer mentioned, it's a very common occurrence. There are 49,000 of these emergency passports that are issued overseas every year. Here in Montreal, we're very close to the U.S. border. We have a lot of U.S. visitors. About 1.5 million American citizens visit the city every summer. So some days we're doing 6, 7, 8 of these a day in addition to our routine service load. So it's something that happens every day. They do find their way to us, and we try to get them on their way as soon as possible. You know, for us, an emergency passport, it's another day at the office, but we recognize for that American citizen it's probably not been a very good day. They might have missed a flight. They might have had their car broken into. It might have been some kind of crisis precipitated them needing to come in. And we just want to get them over that as quickly as we can.
Give me an idea of some of the more surprising things that you have encountered as a consular officer. Not just you're working in Montreal and in Canada now, but thinking back to some of your other posts, maybe in Nigeria or Morocco. What are some of the surprising things that might bring someone into your office?
Well, Jeff and I started talking about some of the routine services we provide, and most of our workday is thankfully at the level of routine service, but there's a whole other category of services we provide, emergency and special citizen services, that are kind of in exceptional circumstances and emergency situations. And really, for any of our missions anywhere in the world, the safety and security of U.S. citizens is our top priority. It's why we're here as consular officers, and really why we're here as missions. We help Americans by giving assistance and information if they're injured. Sometimes they're arrested and need help or assistance in getting back to the United States. We find or field thousands of welfare and whereabouts inquiries each and every year where friends and family members are trying to find someone overseas. We try to assist them in that process. We help parents that are adopting overseas as they document new family members for immigration to the United States. And we also help other parents that connect with children who may have been abducted by another parent to another country and to have that child return to the United States if possible. So I know Jeff has had some very particular experiences with emergency services overseas, and there are a few others he might be able to recount here too.
Yeah, Jeff Gringer, I am not asking you to violate anybody's privacy, but can you tell us about a circumstance that you've been involved with?
Well, I see a lot of prison cases and psych cases. Basically, Americans that are essentially debilitated by mental illness when they come overseas, often they're alone and they can get committed to a local facility. France seemed to see those fairly frequently. I used to go to all the mental facilities and check out my people. And you would have people essentially just melting down And what we could do is we check in on them, and we always try to get a Privacy Act waiver signed, because we cannot let friends and family members know unless they give us explicit written release to talk about their case. And in some instances, they never wanted to do that. I had one case in Paris where the person was extremely disturbed. I was engaging her in a conversation, and I tell them, you know, your family is very worried about you. And she said, oh, I talk to them all the time. I go, no, you haven't. But I had a cell phone with me. She refused to sign the Privacy Act waiver document. And I said, well, and it was like 3 o'clock Paris time, and they had family in the Midwest. And I said, now would be a good time to call. Would you like to talk to your father? And she gave me the number, and I just passed the phone to her, and she started talking to them. And that really helped, because all of a sudden she could see how worried the parents were, and that sort of injected reality into the situation. And instead of using a Privacy Act waiver, I was able to use that cell phone to get her to contact her parents and say, oh, I see you're worried about me. I don't know where I am. And so I had to tell her the address of the facility she was being held at.
Wow. So without getting that waiver, you were really the only person that she was in contact with.
Well, and her French psychiatrist there, too. But they would usually be very good about reaching out to the embassy to try and help those people, and they'd certainly like to get them home, too.
Charity, if I could add, I mean, in cases like Jeff is talking about here and in others, one of the roles consular officers often play is this link or bridge of information with families back in the United States, with the host government. We kind of play a facilitation or liaison role with these individual cases. In the cases of mental health, which is it's a very common scenario overseas, it can be quite difficult, and sometimes they even end in arrest or incarceration for that American citizen, which adds a whole other layer of difficulty to the case. I'll give an example from one of my prior postings. I mentioned parental abduction, and it's one of the most difficult types of cases a consular officer might be confronted with in their career. It's when a custody case becomes international, when one parent takes a child to another country, you really have a very complex interplay of two systems, law and procedure, might be at loggerheads, and you have this child in the middle. Sometimes these cases go on for years, and the consular officer often has to play the role of a conduit of communication between the child and the parent that's left behind in the United States. We really do this by trying to help the left-behind parent navigate and interface with the local system. We follow court proceedings regarding the custody of their child. We communicate again with the host government in an effort to reunite the family where we can. We're not lawyers, we're not their counsel, but we're more eyes and ears and, again, a liaison with local authority. And I think even more importantly than that, we become this mechanism for them to actually communicate directly with the children. Sometimes they're very cut off from the children that have been taken overseas, and we conduct regular visits to the child at their home, at their school. We ascertain what their conditions are. We speak with them about their life, their room, the sports they're involved in, the activities they like, the television programs, all the daily things they would normally talk about with the left-behind parent. We try to help get those details back to the parent. We also pass along photos, communication, gifts, any number of things that help link the left-behind parent to the child that's been taken overseas. And I'll give you just one example from a recent post. I had one of these cases that had been going on for a number of years. At the request of the parent in the United States, I conducted a visit on the child's birthday. So I was able to take gifts, photos, letters from the parent and the sibling to the child. This was really the only connection that child was able to have with their family in the United States, and I was able to spend that afternoon with them. And I often think of that case when I do my work. It's a very human scale in the work that we do, and it just reminds me why consular officers in particular, I think, have a very privileged role in what we do for Americans overseas.
Now, hopefully most people who are traveling abroad or need to engage with their consular officer aren't in that kind of situation, but what kind of advice do you have for Americans who are traveling abroad this summer? Jeff Osweiler?
Well, there are a few things that I'm sure both chefs here have some examples that have come up in our work. The first thing I would say, it's simple advice, but I'm a simple man, is protect your passport. We see lots, as Jeff said, lots of lost and stolen passports, break-ins, hotel thieves, whatever, and the passport is no longer available for the traveler. I always tell people to treat it like you would your wallet or your phone. Keep it on your purse and make it a part of something that's with you at all times. And if you can't do that, at least keep it in a safe. Don't keep it with things that thieves really want, like laptops, bags, other valuables. They really don't want your passport. There's not a lot of utility or value for most thieves in a passport. What they want is the thing that it's with. And definitely don't leave it in a car. Most of the cases we see here in Montreal involve some kind of a car break-in where a bag is taken and the passport's inside. The other thing I would say about passports is make sure you have at least 6 months of validity left on it whenever you travel. There are a lot of countries out there now where they require at least 6 months in order for you to enter the country. Most European countries are that way. And you want to make sure you've got enough validity left on the passport to actually get on the plane and travel. We've done a lot of emergency passports in that context.
And I can imagine that could be something easy to overlook.
Yeah, it's a detail a lot of people don't check before they actually head to the airport, and it's sort of a nasty surprise when they get there. The second thing I'll suggest is, if you can, register your trip with the Department of State. We have a special system called the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program. It's sort of an electronic itinerary and contact card that you file with the Department of State, and it helps us give you information in times of crisis. It helps us connect you with friends and family if there's some sort of personal emergency. It's really just a way that we can communicate with you if there's some sort of a situation where you need to be reached. It's easy to do. It's free. You can do it online at the State Department's travel website, which is www.travel.state.gov. And as Jeff mentioned earlier, we take very seriously the protection of your personal information. The information we provide is just for the purposes of assisting you in a crisis.
Well, Jeffs, we're out of time, but thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
Jeff, thank you for having us on.
Yeah,
much
Jeff,
appreciated.
Jeff Osweiler grew up in Ames, Iowa. He is now in Montreal, Canada, as a consular officer there. Jeff Gringer grew up in Iowa City, and he is in Stockholm, again, working as a consular officer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.